This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I don't think anyone would argue with the fact that swift and amazing changes have taken place in this, the digital age. But according to a pair of executives from Google, we ain't seen nothing yet.
In the future, when every child has a smartphone in their hands, they're going to, for the first time, have a weapon to fight rote memorization and bad educational systems with critical thinking, interaction, and informal education.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear a conversation with this pair of high-tech execs about what they call the new digital age. We'll also hear about technology you can wear and how it's improving the study of people with autism. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In an unparalleled collaboration, two leading global thinkers in technology and foreign affairs give us their widely anticipated transformational vision of the future, a world where everyone is connected, a world full of challenges and benefits that are ours to meet and to harness. The result is the book, The Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. Eric Schmidt is one of Silicon Valley's great leaders, having taken Google from a small startup to one of the world's most influential companies. Jared Cohen is the director of Google Ideas and a former advisor to Secretaries of State Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton. With their combined knowledge and experience, the authors are uniquely positioned to take on some of the toughest questions about the future. Who will be more powerful in the future, the citizen or the state? Will technology make terrorism easier or harder to carry out? What's the relationship between privacy and security, and how much will we have to give up to be a part of the new digital age? The Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Donahue spoke with this impressive duo and asked where we are in this new digital age.
This is Eric. When we look at what's going to happen, it's overwhelmingly good. And it's mostly because of the arrival of mobile devices for people who have had no information at all. So if you think about it, you've got 5 billion people or so who are going to join the internet over the next 5 to 10 years. They're going to upgrade their existing, shall we say, dumb phones to these smart browser-based phones. And when they do that, they're going to have access to all the world's information, all the entertainment, all the narratives, all the education, all the medical care. Their lives being safe and growing and good economics are good for America. In America, we're also going to see a huge explosion in the kinds of things we can do. Think of amazing personal digital assistants that will tell you what's going to happen, predict things, help you out with your daily life. All of that will happen much quicker than anyone ever thought.
And Jared, with that said, there is a somber tone that you take in part of the book, because with that comes great responsibility.
Of course, and part of the reason we decided to write this book is we were tired of what seems to be the dominant present-day debate, which focuses on, is technology good or is technology bad? And such a debate neglects the inevitability of 5 billion new people coming online. And so what we chose to do is write an honest account of the good and the bad that awaits us. Now, anybody that watches the news, reads a paper, goes online to see what's happening, knows that the world is not perfect. There's terrorism challenges, there's rogue state challenges, there's huge poverty and inequality challenges. Our book looks at when 5 billion new people come online, how technology empowers people both for good and for ill, and what we do about it.
And Eric, with that good and bad that await us, how much do we know and how much is working that we're not sure of?
You know, I think that we can sort of see the next 5 years, and we know that the scenario I described around mobility and access to information will happen. What we don't know is how many bad people there are and what they'll do with that infrastructure. So you could imagine, for example, evil gangs finding hackers and together combining them to build new ways to attack the cyber infrastructure. You could imagine governments deciding that they don't really want you to know everything that's going on, think China here, that export censorship and try to keep their people in a state of denial. So these are things we talk about in the book. We also think there are good political and technical solutions to them, but they need to be worked on.
And one of the ways that we discuss this in the book is to the extent that everything between individuals that seek to promote good and individuals that seek to wreak havoc is collaborative. We argue that in the future, everybody is going to be connected. For people on the side of good, that means more witnesses. That means the ability to collectively press rewind, as we saw in Boston. That means a partnership between law enforcement and citizens on the ground. For those that are terrorists and criminals, what it means is the room for error becomes more significant. If you saw the news in the last week, there was a story of a $45 million ATM heist worldwide. And what was extraordinary about this is you had hackers and professional criminals who were good at being invisible who found that they still needed street criminals to go to the ATMs. And the street criminals posted photos of themselves online bragging with $40,000 in cash. And in a networked world, if somebody's a criminal and makes a mistake, the entire network comes unraveled.
What happens, though, when we look at the world as white hats and black hats and good and evil, and there are those players in the world that look at you, that look at Google, and say, you're the evil ones?
Well, we obviously don't agree with that, so I need to have some more specifics. Google is organized around getting all the world's information to everybody, and we do so largely for free. So I would sort of say that's a pretty good starting mission. And let me know what your complaints are.
Well, and certainly you know the complaints that have come in around the world of people that are trying to suppress what we here in the Western world have.
Well, that doesn't make them right.
Of course not.
The human condition requires information. Jared and I traveled to a number of very unpleasant places, most notably North Korea, which is still very closed, Myanmar, Burma, which is now opening up, where we saw what happens when you don't have information. And now with these modern tools, the citizens can keep their governments, even if they're unelected, somewhat honest. Looking at China, they have a site called Weibo, which is their equivalent of Twitter and Facebook, which keeps the bureaucrats honest. And indeed, after they suppressed information about the train accident, ultimately caused the government to eventually investigate and, in fact, jail the head of the train division.
And I would add one other piece to this, which is 57% of the world's population lives under some kind of autocracy. That 57% of the world's population also happens to be some of the poorest people on Earth. What we found in our travels to 30-plus countries, places like Myanmar, Libya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, is in these environments you have large numbers of people who have heard of the internet even though they've never used it. And their understanding of the internet is associated with free speech, freedom of assembly, civil liberties that they wouldn't otherwise have when the world was entirely physical. So what we found is that the internet is even more powerful than just a resource and just a tool. It's powerful as an idea. And as an idea, it's permeating these autocratic societies and challenging an era where people knew no civil liberties.
When you went to North Korea, for example, does it surprise you then when that trip alone raises the hackles of some in Washington, John McCain, for one, who says that it's a self-appointed delegation of useful idiots?
Well, Senator McCain is a great American statesman. However, he's wrong on this particular case. I don't know how we're going to deal with North Korea going forward, but I can tell you that the sanctions strategy of the current U.S. government is insufficient to have a big impact because the borders are porous and they had lots of products that they were getting through China and other mechanisms, including many American products. So it seems to me that a straightforward analysis says the best way to fix things in North Korea is to empower the citizens of North Korea, who are the most sheltered. They have no textbooks, no radio, no information. They don't know what's going on in the world. Get them some information and trust that they will, out of their own goodness of their hearts and their own caring about people, go and put pressure on their government to become a little bit less dangerous.
And Joe, as somebody who worked in government for 4 years, the observation that I made then and that I'll make now is dictators in the future and autocracies in the future are going to find themselves facing quite the dilemma. And the reason I say they face a dilemma is because for them, technology is both a carrot and a stick, and they don't know how to make sense of that contradiction. It's a carrot in the sense that countries like North Korea, you know, other countries that are autocratic, they cannot develop and grow economically if they don't at least open up some kind of access. And it's a stick in the sense that by opening up access, you empower the population to challenge what in North Korea is a cult of personality. Somebody has to talk about the technological path that the North Koreans need to go down. And our view is government will do their top-down thing. To the extent that the private sector can play a valuable role from the bottom up that helps citizens, we want to do that.
You mentioned your government time working in the State Department. So with that said, Jared, can't autocracies keep the internet out, though?
There's only two countries in the entire world that have kept the internet out, and one of them is already finding that the walls that they set up are reasonably porous, and that's Cuba. North Korea never let the connectivity in the first place, but even North Korea is beginning to very, very slowly change. Go ahead, Eric.
Even the most brutal dictator cannot run the country without some level of connectivity. So on a go-forward basis, I think we can say we will be able to talk to the citizens in these repressive regimes somehow.
And we make the argument in the book that there's no country that's worse off as a result of the internet's arrival.
So with this, of course, comes the issue of privacy versus security. And you make the case that there will be, and if there isn't already, this absence of a delete button. There are things that are on a permanent record. How do we as people come to terms with that?
Since you asked the question about people, there's two arguments that we make in the book. One, technology and more connectivity does not absolve us as humans of responsibility to exercise good judgment. And two, as kids are coming online younger and faster in an era where people put their sonograms online, I'm very upset that parents are putting their sonograms online without at least getting a squint or a subtle smile from a newly born baby. But our argument is as kids come online younger and faster than at any other time in history, parents are going to have to talk to them about the importance of data permanence years before they have the sex talk.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen about their book, The New Digital Age Continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1186. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Eric Schmidt, a Google executive who took Google from a small startup to one of the world's most influential companies, and Jared Cohen, director of Google Ideas. They're speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about their new book, The New Digital Age.
So the question comes, Eric, and I guess it's obviously a complex question, and that is, what's Google's role in the future of online privacy? And I guess I can even expand that to when we're talking about this new digital age, and as the subtitle of the book suggests, reshaping the future of people and nations and business, and the incredible importance that this has in our lives, how much of that is up to you as a company and working with other companies? I certainly understand the entrepreneurial spirit, but because of the great stakes, how do we work together to make that click and avoid future concerns, especially when it comes to security and privacy and cyber terrorism?
I think from a Google perspective, the most important thing for us to do is to make sure that the information that we store is in fact secure. We owe it to our users worldwide that the information that we collect, of which there's much, is not released and violating your privacy. So that's our sort of primary duty. With respect to things like cyber terrorism and cyber war, that's really the responsibility of governments. When Google was attacked by China, I learned that we're not allowed to attack back. only the governments can attack back. And so we, of course, you call the FBI, the FBI calls in the NSA, and then there's a process that they follow. But Google's responsibility at some basic level is to protect the information that you give us so that others cannot use that to violate your privacy.
Jared, one of the things that you write about in the book, and it was one of the most powerful things that I read in the book, which is that ultimately this power of information is underrated. How so?
Let's take education as a starting point. One of the arguments that we make in the new digital age is if you believe, as we do, that poor educational systems all around the world are at least in part at the source of all the world's problems, let's look at the status quo, which is most of the world, if they're learning at all, teaching their kids through rote memorization. And in certain parts of the world that are radicalized, you know, teaching kids really bad things through rote memorization. In the future, when every child has a smartphone in their hands, they're going to, for the first time, have a weapon to fight rote memorization and bad educational systems with critical thinking, interaction, and informal education.
Give them a choice of ideologies and not condemn them to be the slaves of these ideologues that force them into these evil acts.
So give them tools and allow them to understand them.
I mean, the reality is nobody's born wanting to be a violent extremist. It's, as Eric mentioned, an absence of choices and an absence of alternatives, and a smartphone is an intervention that gives an outlet.
I mean, you mentioned this a moment ago, but forecasting that in the next decade, the world's virtual population will outnumber the physical population. So what does that do for data, and what will it do ultimately for empowering citizens?
Well, we like talking about what it will do in terms of challenging dictators and creating dilemmas for dictators, which is a nice thing to think about in the future. So let's take a country like Iran, which is about to go into a presidential election next month, and nobody knows what will happen. In the physical world, Iran has a population of 72 million people. Roughly a quarter of them are online today. In the future, when everybody's online and has multiple email accounts and multiple social networking profiles and multiple chatting services, the Iranian population online will look more like 500 million people. That's a lot of noise. That's a lot of activity. That's a lot of challenges to the regime. You know, my sort of message to those autocrats is good luck figuring out what's noise and what's real. And ultimately, democracy is on the right side here.
And the downside, Eric?
I think the empowerment bias is profound. It also empowers people who want to do evil. And the determination of whether people are going to do bad things or good things is largely cultural. And there will always be psychopaths. There will always be people who are dangerous. We will do a better job of detecting them because it's very difficult to completely hide your tracks if you're an evil person from the police in the internet. In the book, we talk about a Taliban commander who we heard about who had managed to cover up his tracks on cell phones for a year, and then one day makes a mistake because he wants to go to his cousin's wedding, and 45 minutes later, he's apprehended.
When it comes to our understanding of the internet, of our understanding of what is possible, of our understanding of even what is possible with the device, the smartphones that we have at our disposal and we have in our hands. Is it safe to say that most of us don't even scratch the surface of understanding that?
I would make a general statement that people are not used to the Moore's Law level of compounding of change. Moore's Law says that computation roughly doubles in performance every 2 years. There's essentially nothing in our daily lives, with the exception of computers, that doubles every 2 years in terms of price performance. Imagine if cars and gasoline and so forth fell in price for the same function every 2 years. What an extraordinarily different world we would have today. So the compounding of this rate of change is what is always a surprise. And we tend to underestimate in the long term what is possible. We know with modern artificial intelligence that new algorithms, new computers, new companies will come along with amazingly insightful things. It will help humans get the job done every day. In the book, we talk about you wake up in the morning and there's a big screen and you look at it and it says, "Hello, Eric." And I would say something to the effect of, "Do I need to get up?" And it says, "We have looked at all the things that are going to happen today and no, you can go back to sleep." That would be a very useful product.
Or imagine you're a nomad. You know, Eric and I went to a nomadic village in Kenya. You can imagine for a cattle herder in the morning whose big question is, where's the best place to get water? Where's the best place to take the livestock grazing? What are the prices today? You can imagine all of that being available on his or her smartphone at the time of waking up.
And with that information, do you think we are we intimidated by it? Do we, even if we don't truly understand it, do you think that we'll get better at educating people as to what is possible, given that it's all changing so quickly?
I would say that we've gone through a period of time in computing where the computer engineers were building products that only they could understand, to a new generation of products which are much more human, normal human designed. I always use the question of, can my mother understand it? Can she use it?
Right.
You know, a normal person, not a technical person. And I think we've made that breakthrough in the last 5 years. If you look at Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, the leading online sites of one kind or another, they have amazingly new good human factors. And the next generation of startups, which are on Android and iPhones, have beautiful interfaces that explain to you what they're doing. So I think that breakthrough means that you will see the benefits of what I'm talking about without having to master the complexity, and that's a big deal.
Again, the name of Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen's new book is The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Businesses. They spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Part of that new digital age is wearable technology that's improving our understanding of people with autism. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. To date, most autism studies have focused mainly on those with moderate to good communication skills. Matthew Goodwin, assistant professor of health science at Northeastern University, explains the development of wearable technology poised to provide data about those at the opposite end of the autism spectrum.
1 in 88 children are currently diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. This creates a public health problem in that there will always be more people with autism than experts to assess and teachers to assist them. Yet much of today's research is primarily focused on what causes the disorder, like genes and brain differences, and we're a long way from understanding those systems. The net result is science currently has very little clinical translation that directly impacts people who are living with autism. Of the clinical studies done, most focus on a convenient sample of high-functioning children with the mildest forms of autism, children who have normal IQs and good verbal ability. The sample is convenient because they can go to an unfamiliar place with an unfamiliar person for some undefined period of time and perform tasks they've never done before, all of which requires a lot of self-regulation. But as many as half of children on the autism spectrum are too severely impacted to comply with current research protocols. These are the children we understand the least and the ones we need to help the most. So instead of bringing these individuals into the lab, my work attempts to take the lab to them. I work with computer scientists and electrical engineers to make that happen. Experts who create sensors that can be woven into clothes, embedded into accessories, or inserted into devices that can be carried or worn. These enable us to measure physical activity patterns and internal states like physiological arousal. To interpret the data, we also need context, where the person is and what he or she is doing. So we also instrument spaces with video cameras, microphones, and other environmental sensors. By bringing these wearable and environmental technologies together, we get powerful information in natural settings, at home, at school, and in the community, about what is happening in an individual with more challenging forms of autism. My collaborators and I believe this approach will help us understand this segment of the population better and identify more impactful treatments.
That was Matthew Goodwin of Northeastern University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.